in January 1958 is when I actually arrived. It was fairly early in, well, Noel Annan's provostship was the provost, my first, as it were, provostship recollection. And he became provost in, I think I'm right in saying, 19... No point in guessing if one has a reference book to hand. Yes, he became provost in 1956 and remained provost till 1966. He always said he'd keep it for 10 years, and he did, just about. So he was my provost in 1958. Gabriel Horn was about the same time, a little bit before me, I think he became a fellow, the same year, 1958.
Yes.
And
What was Noel Annan like?
Well, I wanted to talk about Noel. That's why I was careful to check his dates, because he was my first provost. I think he was extremely good, and it was a very good introduction to a king's, which is now, alas, I think, faded, except from the memory of people like me. I remember the memorial service to Dady Rylands, who was a very close friend of both his and mine, the memorial service. We processed out of chapel together through the west door, which was cast wide for us to exit. And I think we were holding hands. We certainly had tears rolling down our cheeks. And when we got outside the west door of the chapel, Noel turned to me and said, "That is the end of the kings you and I have known and loved." Only a few months later, of course, one was at his memorial service. Surprise, surprise, rapid cancer of the lung, which took him off with very little space. And I remember at that west door again, the last madrigal was sung. I'd love to find where he got it, because it has the line, "More geese than swans," in it. Noel and I were, I must say that people of that particular generation of king's men, in which I include myself, though I was not an undergraduate here, I was an undergraduate at first of all at Liverpool University and then at the School of Oriental and African Studies post-war, 1946. And but of course, King's was a college with which I'd always been acquainted, and of which I think an ancestor of mine who presented some silver in the 17th century must have been a member. They were, well, they became, whatever the silver was he presented was melted down and became beakers in the 18th century, because in the old days they used to use silver for whatever it was most required for. Therefore, if it was candlesticks and they wanted beakers, they melted the candlesticks down and made beakers, and I suppose the reverse process went on. However, King's was the college to which I was most attached, and happily for me, of course, I had a number of friends who were fellows of King's, including Dady Rylands and Noel. So that when I arrived in Cambridge as a lecturer with no college, it was a delight that within about 24 hours I got a letter from Noel saying that if I cared to join him in his study at, I think, 11:45 the following day, he'd like to talk to me. So, of course, I was there and we drank a bottle of hock in 10 minutes. he only had a very short time to spare. What he wanted to do was to say, would I be willing to be a member of the college? And secondly, that of course it was not in his hands, it was in the hands of the Vice Provost, who dealt with the statistics of fellowships and all that kind of thing, but that he wondered whether I'd like to be a member? And I said, of course, yes. And so I very quickly was received a letter from John Saltmarsh, who was then the Vice Provost, informing me that I was a member of the college. Happy days. That was in 1958, immediately after I was appointed to my lectureship. It was some years later when the university decided to encourage colleges to make a number of lecturers who were not fellows, to make them fellows, to give them fellowships. It was about, when did I become a fellow? I've forgotten.
Were you not a fellow at this point?
I became a member, you see.
A member. Appointment. Oh, right. This was a member of High Table, is it? Or?
I suppose so. I don't know what it meant, really. Yes, I became a fellow. A senior member, it's called, 1958, MA 1959, because it was in December 1958. And then doesn't say when I became a fellow.
You knew roughly when it was?
It was about 3 years later.
So about 61, 62.
That's it. Fellow, yes. Fellow, 64.
64, right.
Yes. When the university encouraged, I was one of those picked. That very nice man who used to be in charge of the Botanical Gardens, what was his name? Max,
yes.
The trouble of being 85 years of age is that
well,
one gets named.
Not just 85.
Walters.
Walters, yes. Max Walters.
Max Walters, yes. He and I were chosen at the same time. I think largely through the agency of Dady and Christopher Morris and Tim Mumby. They were great friends of mine. And of course the point about going back to the college as it is at present in 2008, the point I wish to make is that the college lacks that ballast, that leavening of older and devoted senior fellows now who understood the conventions of the college and its traditions, and who regarded it as a collegiate community, the driving force of which was friendship and love. And they were the people who constituted the King's College I first knew, starting with Noel the Provost and Dady Rylands and Christopher Morris and Tim Mumby and Braithwaite and others. Gabriel Horne and Dan Brown were more or less my contemporaries, and they were of course good friends, and Jasper Rose was a particularly important element in the fellowship as far as I was concerned, because I later learnt that Noel, typical of Noel, told Jasper, he said, you must talk to Peter, he's new and he's a stranger to Cambridge, so pick him up and take him away and have a good talk. So one day at lunchtime I was going out across to my faculty room, which in those days was in Downing Street, and this strange, rather eccentric looking man with long hair and slightly unkempt appearance.
He was a sociologist, was he? Or?
No, Jasper was a historian.
Ah, yes.
His bust is in fact on a bookcase in there near the window. came and introduced himself, and I only later learned that he was doing so at the prompting of Noel Annan. I mention this, I emphasise this, because of course it illustrates the communal spirit and the kindness of kings of those days, and the concern for each other. And so Jasper and I walked across to my faculty room and started a conversation which is now by letter but still going on 50 odd years later. The beginning of the conversation in my room, we were talking so loudly that Miss Van Rankin, the archaeologist who had the next room, was wondering whether she shouldn't ask for the caretaker or the police or somebody to come in, because she thought we were having a terrible row. We were just having an extremely vigorous conversation. And that was, of course, an important... He and Jean, his wife, became very important elements in my life. And then very early on, Michael Jaffe was very good to me. And I remember Michael coming to where I was then lodging one evening, and we drank tea, pot after pot of tea. I had a silver teapot which we kept brewing fresh tea, and had a long... That was my beginning of my friendship with Michael Jaffe, a friendship which again lasted, of course, until his lamentable death. And so this was the almost cosy kings that I first knew, high intellectual and cultural standards, high appreciation, aesthetical appreciation as well as scholarly, and a wonderful community to belong to. And of course I find it difficult now to cope with an increasingly bureaucratic college, ridden with, weighed down by probably too large a fellowship, a fellowship consisting of many who I think regard it mainly as a postal address and a place to have lunch in, whereas we regarded it as home. And also, of course, it's...
But were a lot of these people living in the college that you mentioned?
Well, no, of course, Christopher wasn't.
Tim Mumby wasn't.
Tim Mumby wasn't. Michael Jaffe was.
Yes.
Michael Jaffe was then living in the rooms above this one.
Mm. But they would dine in the evenings a lot.
Oh, yes, we dined. And Donald Beavis, Donald Beavis was one of those who was peculiarly good to me when I first became a member. I remember our first conversation with Donald, because the fellows then lunched at a table down the side of the hall, followed by a table for the BAs. But of course, Jasper, we were encouraged to go and eat with the undergraduates, and I remember Noel chiding me for not doing so, and I said, well, I'm shy, I said to the undergraduates. If I go and sit next to an undergraduate and ask him what he's reading, won't he turn to me and say, what the hell's it got to do with you? And he said, no, don't be so silly, Peter, you must go and talk to them. He always made a point of lunching or having part of his lunch, his sweet, for example, at an undergraduate's table with undergraduates. But as I say, the fellows and members of the senior members of the college lunched at this separate table. And I remember Donald sitting opposite to me, and we had a very nice fish. Mr. Wallace was the chef, and with a tomato sauce that he'd put on it. And Donald saying, I said, he's a good chef. He said, yes, he's very good. He had no palate. Fancy serving tomato sauce with a fish like this. He said, it should have been, well, presumably he meant it should have been tartar sauce or something like that. And Donald, of course, was a great friend, because his mother was Staffordshire, and I'm a Staffordshire man on my mother's side too. And my father's side is Norfolk, and Norfolk and Derby, Derbyshire. And of course, I always used to say to Donald that he got a typical Staffordshire face. He had, as a matter of fact. And but of course, he was a Beavis of Worthing. Always used to like to remind me that there's a Beavis Tower in Arundel Castle. And I was very fond of Donald, and he was in those days. I remember he always used to serve his gins and tonics in Regency bumpers, which are very large. I mean, it's like sort of consuming a bucket full of gin and tonic. And we used to, and there was Pop Prior, his, whom he was, of course, friendly with, who was the wife of the first professor in Cambridge of French, and who was the widow of that professor, and, of course, had been, well, they used to, there was a rumour that Donald was the Donald and Pop Prior were the originals of Terence Rattigan's play, the, what was it called, the, the name of the play, about the sixth form boy and the master's wife. Well, it really involved, except that, of course, they were very close friends, and Pop had the privilege of using Donald's account at the wine cellar, a combination of pantry, so that he had, which he lived in a house in Scroope Terrace, perhaps the last resident in a whole house in Scroope Terrace, where she used to give marvellous parties, and where she took in rather aristocratic young ladies, as it were, from Denmark and elsewhere, who'd come to England to polish up their English, and were her lodgers. And she was a very interesting woman, always. She and Donald, between them, principally her, principally she, invented the Badrick, the singing on the river.
Really? What date was that?
I don't know what date she did. It was done, it was happening by my time.
Mm.
And we used to watch it from Donald's room, which was in Bodley's, the part jutting out to towards the river. We used to sit on the window seats with the open window and listen to it.
Mm.
And happy times. Of course, Donald had a large suite with one of the rooms, now two suites, I think, two sets. One of them was his dining room. He was a man of great hospitality and a most lovable and loving man, of tremendous integrity and decency. That was another characteristic of King's men in those days. And this tremendous kindness. I mean, if one were ill for a few days or longer, and went back to, when one arrived back in the combination room in the evening for dinner, they'd all come and say, you know, how are you, feeling better, and shake hands, and a tremendous camaraderie, all of which, I may be wrong, seems to me to have more or less disappeared. And so that Dady, of course, was a great friend, but I'd known Dady prior to coming up, and Dady was, of course, very special.
What can you paint a picture of Dady? I mean, what sort of man was
he? Dady, I can only think of episodes. I remember when his friend Anthony Blunt was exposed as a double agent, and of course I'm sure that Dady, as with so many others, had no idea of this activity of this great friend. He was always wanting me to meet Sir Anthony Blunt. But Providence looked after me carefully, and though I had plenty of opportunity and knew many men who knew them, I never met either Burgess or Maclean or Anthony Blunt or, for that matter, Kim
Philby.
Mm. So though I was in the Middle East, and the Middle East, and I never met any of these gentlemen. But I shall never forget when Anthony was exposed, I happened to be going across to the pantry to get some drink, some booze. And I met Dady coming along the path from where his rooms are in the old lodge, or where. And he'd aged 10 years in a matter of days. And so I waited for him at the door to the combination complex, and said, when he got up to me, I said, come and have a drink. And he said, yes, a little bit of whiskey. And so he came. I got the whiskey, of course. Crawford's was his favourite whiskey, his favourite tipple. And he came a few minutes later, and we sat there in the outer room. And we drank and we talked. We had all sorts of things. And as he told Stephen Runciman, who was also a great friend of mine and of his, as he told Stephen Runciman, because Stephen later told me, he said, you know, it was extraordinarily tactful of Peter and rather typical of him. He had me for drinks. I knew why. and he never mentioned it. And, of course, naturally I didn't. I wasn't going to rub it in. I knew that what disappointment and dismay he must have been going through because of Anthony Blunt's, the revelation about Anthony Blunt. So Dedede was a very important influence in our, in one's life.
Did you go to any of the plays he
yes,
performed
it's
in?
Yes, Whiskey.
Did you go to any plays that he performed? I mean, he was a good actor, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a splendid actor, yes. No, I never actually saw him act. I've seen and can still see him, Ian McKellen, and various people, actors whom he trained.
Mm.
He used to talk about, of course, theatre and elocution particularly. He used to say the trouble nowadays is that they all mutter. They don't speak clearly. Mm. And I used to say, no, my mother always taught me that when I started to mutter, my mother always used to say, if anything is worth saying, it's worth saying audibly. And somebody said to me the other day, I telephoned them and left a message on their answering service, and they told me on Sunday, yesterday, they said, I kept that recording because you speak so clearly. Well, I said I was taught to. Mm. And I remember Dede, there was an actor I met at a house party in Yorkshire who was struggling about, worried about a piece that he'd got to broadcast and it was in verse. And John Heath Stubbs, my friend, the poet, always used to say that Dede Rylands was the last man in England who knew how to say English poetry. And so I had him to lunch with Dede. I told Dede, you help this boy. And they had a great talk about theatre until eventually I said, Dede, you seem to have forgotten the purpose of this luncheon. Oh, no, dear, I haven't. And then he, of course, told the boy about the prevalence of Anglo-Saxon originated of words in English poetry and the long vowels. And made him learn, you know, made him say one or two lines, and then said, what you should do is to learn a Shakespeare sonnet and go into the park in the morning, he lived in London, and just say it, shout it, cry it, but say it over and over again in different keys, so to speak. It was a very interesting example of Dede's technique. And, of course, he was a man of tremendous... he always used to have me on my birthday, the 15th of May. He always used to have me with a bottle of champagne. And I was allowed to take whomever I would like to take with me. And I remember one occasion opening the champagne and making a mess of it, and Dede saying to the person who was with me, you see, you can't even open a bottle of champagne, and he's 38. And but he was very good, very sweet, very tart. He could be very tart. He could be quite angry. I remember a terrible row he had with Jasper Rose in the entrance to the hall one day, calling Jasper a bore. Well, Jasper was rather unconventional and rather unlike Dede, and rather anti- any kind of snobbery. Not that Dede was a snob, but he was an old Etonian and Jasper Rose wasn't. Jasper went to Cheltenham. But my favourite story about Jasper Rose was when he was taken as a sixth form boy from Cheltenham, a friend of his father's. His father was professor of German at LSE. Will Rose, Wham, we used to call him. His father's a wonderful man. And a friend of his father's took this young sixth form boy to dinner at All Souls, and they sat next to Rouse, Ale Rouse.
Yes,
he said, there are Rose. Now you must be one. Are you related to Sir Francis Rose, the Devonshire Roses? No, Jasper said, I'm not. Oh, well, then you must be related to the so and so Roses, the Scottish Roses, also baronets. No, Jasper said, I'm not. So Rouse tried to place him with various elements of the baronetage which happened to have the name Rose, until Jasper blurted out, he said, no. He said, I think my grandfather was a Jewish tailor in Birmingham, probably called Rosenberg.
That stopped the conversation, I
that
think.
That stopped the conversation. Grouse had no more to say to him for the rest of the meal. like my friend Hugh Trevor Roper. Jasper and Hugh Trevor Roper did not share any kind of pity for Mr. Rouse. It wasn't at all. I remember Hugh Trevor Roper boasting to me that I cut him dead on the steps of the Huntington Library. Which I thought was rather hard. I mean, I was a nice enough old boy.
There was that rather cruel joke. You know, his first book, that is A.L. Rouse's, was called Tudor Cornwall. Yes. And it was the joke was that his first book was called Tudor Cornwall, and his books got cornier and cornier from then on.
That's rather nice, yes.
What was I knew Hugh Trevor Roper a bit. What was he like as you remember?
Well, he was a person. He was extremely good to me, and I was very, very fond of him. The trouble with Hugh was that whenever he became influential in an institution, he promptly started to set everybody in it against each other and against him. And this happened at Peterhouse. I'm in correspondence with his biographer at the moment, and I deeply regret it, really, my decision, but I really had to defend a fellow of Peterhouse, who was a friend of mine, against the absolute vituperation and the vilification and the vindictiveness that Hugh Trevor Roper showed this particular fellow of the college, of Peterhouse, the college of which he'd become a master. I had been asked by Peterhouse whom I would recommend, and I said, well, Hugh Trevor Roper's about to retire from the Regius Professorship at Oxford. He'd do, and he did. He came, but he didn't do. Mm-hmm. And yet one remains very fond of him, especially in retrospect, when I think of how charming he could be, and how kind and thoughtful. So that I was wrong, really, I think, to drop him. But I drop him, I did. He also had me, he used me a bit to preside at dinners when he was at a feast in the college, to help to be a host for Cassandra in the lodge. But
did you know Maurice Cowling?
Yes, very well.
Because, of course, Hugh didn't get on.
Not at all. Not at all. Of course, Maurice had a sharp-edged tongue, too. Yes, I knew Maurice extremely well. But everybody was potentially a shit, if not actually one, in the eyes of Maurice Cowling, I think, sometime or other in the course of his conversation and lucubrations.
I can't imagine him ever saying that about their bursar of the time, which was Tony Wrigley, because Tony was such a pure and serious man. I can't think anyone
knew him.
He was a professor of historical demography and a very good geographer, and president of the British Academy, but he was also a bursar of Peterhouse for a while.
Was he?
And I can't imagine anyone saying anything about Tony.
No. Not even Maurice.
Not even Maurice. What about Mernie Postum? Did you know him at all?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew who he was.
He was at Peterhouse, wasn't he?
Yes, he was at Peterhouse. Yes. Of course, I knew Dennis Brogan very well. And you. And Patrick Brogan, the sons, who were here. And who remained friends, of course. In fact, I think it was it was Patrick who gave me his father's scribbled over and annotated Tooney Library edition of the letters of Madame de Sévigné.
Oh, how nice.
Which was very nice. He knew that she was a favourite of mine, and of course I regard this book as very special.
You said you mentioned Stephen Runciman.
Yes.
He's a very notable figure. So what was he like as a person?
Oh, he was a very kind...
He was a baronet, was he, or a...
No, he was knighted.
Knighted.
Didn't like that. He thought it was rather plebeian.
Because his son is lord.
No, not a son. That's his nephew.
Nephew, ah, right.
Stephen never married.
Ah.
Yes, he was made a knight and didn't like it.
Hmm.
He told the Duchess of Kent, who was a great friend of his, Marina, that he felt that it was rather a sort of bourgeois kind of middle class title.
Hmm.
And she told the Queen, and the Queen was not amused. And the Queen visited back on Stephen, who was at a state banquet at Buckingham Palace for the, I forget who, the Greeks, I suppose, and he was one of those fished afterwards, and the Queen mentioned her displeasure at his remark. And, but they were, the royal family were very kind, too, very fond of him, I mean, and when Lady Chubley gave a big birthday party for herself at the house in Norfolk.
Sandringham?
No, the Chumley House. There's some names, it's dreadful.
Don't worry.
The Great House, one of the most famous houses in England. Anyway, they were there, the royals all came over from Sandringham, and Stephen was put next to the Queen, much to the annoyance of old Master of Christ, what was his name?
Plum, Jack Plum.
Jack Plum.
Yes.
It was very vexed. He was put at a table with no royals on it. Didn't like that, Stephen said.
Did you know Jack?
Yes, I did. Jack, of course, the story that I think Jasper Rose used to tell me about Jack Plum, he was a fellow here, you know, and he wrote the first volume of his life of
Walpole.
Which, of course, was very well received and a very remarkable and important book. And somebody asked him about being a Fellow of Kings. He said, I was a Fellow of Kings. The conversation on the High Table was of such a low grade that I sat and all I could do. In those days, the portrait of Walpole faced it if he was sitting on the inside. I used to stare at the portrait of Walpole because there was nothing else to do. And... But, of course, he later became very friendly with
Princess Margaret.
Oh, very friendly with her and with the Batemans, of course.
Mm.
And handed Princess Margaret over to the Batemans for her weekends with them in place of the weekends she used to spend at
the Batesons. The Batesons. Not
the Batesons.
Yeah.
What did I say?
Batemans.
Batesons, yes, the Batesons. And, of course, they had... And the weekend after weekend, which they found rather irksome.
Yes. Did you get to meet her at all?
Oh, I never met her. I never had any desire to, actually.
Well, Pat, in his interview, I think, mentions this, and he said that she never, even though she used to visit quite often, she never actually got round to suggesting they called her by anything but Your Highness or your whatever it is, you know, the honorary thing, you know, never got... through the shell of formality, really. Although they quite liked her. She had a good sense of humour, apparently.
Oh, yes, she was could be very difficult. And she could be very formal. She, you call her Your Highness first, and then Ma'am, of course. But she could be very formal. And, of course, the Batesons didn't smoke, and she smoked incessantly. I remember, because I was in charge of the college silver for 35 years. I don't got much acknowledgement for that effort. And I remember there was a silver cigarette because we had used to... Bernard Williams said he wouldn't have the silver in the lodge because, for security reasons. And so what happened was when they had distinguished guests and people to the lodge, I used to have to get out the silver, including a silver cigarette box. And but the Bateson said they wouldn't have it, they don't need to have it. I said, well, what do you do when Princess Margaret comes? She said, we leave her to look after herself as regards cigarettes. And I believe she very much enjoyed evensong. She's rather a religiose person. I think she's fond of was fond of high Anglicanism and that sort of thing.
What about yourself? What is your own religious feeling?
Oh, I'm very religious, and but I'm interested in the dignity and the Anglican service, which I think is very moving and very, very, very satisfying. But of course, I did convert to Catholicism in Baghdad,
mm-hmm.
partly because I didn't terribly like the English padre there. And but I now go to, if I go at all, and it's difficult now because I'm not very mobile, but I now go to the chapel just next door to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having a terrible row with Couve de Merville when he was presbyter, Catholic chaplain to the university. And said that I had no right to go there, and I didn't understand the rules of the faith. Well, I said I'm too ecumenical for that, perhaps. But I remember asking Monsignor Gilby when I first became a member of King's, would it be all right if I went to King's College Chapel, to which I'd been as a child and as a boy in the past. And I remember Monsignor Gilby saying, oh, perfectly all right, dear, it's only a concert, isn't it, really? And Monsignor Gilby was one of the more remarkable characters I've known in Cambridge. I think I'm inclined to agree with a number of people who talk to me about Cambridge. The days of the characters seem to be over, more or less. Characters like Simpson in Trinity, and who wrote the first volume of a great work on Napoleon III and never wrote another word, and who Holly Williams, who was the Dean of Trinity, yet another character, he said to me on the anniversary of the Battle of Britain, because Simpson, surprise, surprise, had been a pilot, you know, and had a DFC, you never think it, and he gave the claret for the High Table. Said as they were processing out to Harry, was the wine all right? Harry said, yes, it was delicious. I'd have made it champagne, but I thought it would be too ostentatious, said Simpson. He used to go round Cambridge with a pair of secateurs, you know, trimming all the hedges. And very eccentric character. But there were great characters there, and I suppose in a way people like Dady and Donald Beavis were...
John Saltmarsh, he always...
John Saltmarsh is a great character, yes. I remember when I first became a member, he had me to dinner. He introduced me to the High Table, you see, as was the sort of thing that Vice Provosts in those days did. And Vice Provosts in those days, you see, have new members of staff, new porters or new chefs or new members of the executive side of the staff. They used to bring them round, you know, and introduce them to us. So that we would know them and they would know us.
That doesn't happen now.
It's the kind of thing I'm talking about. The way it's changed. Of course, people like Christopher Morris lived at home in Derby Street. And they entertained undergraduates and fellows every Sunday to sumptuous lunches. Helen was a very good cook, and those are special occasions. But you've read Tam Diel's obituary of her, I think, in one of
them. Helen?
Helen.
No, I haven't, actually. No. I don't think so.
When she died, he wrote a very interesting obituary. I can't remember which paper it was in, the Independent.
I think the Independent.
What
was, going back to John Saltmarsh, I just remember him as someone wearing sort of gaiters and...
gaiters and sideburns.
Yes, that's right.
And
there were...
every weekend he walked. Of course, he used to go to Norfolk and walk miles on the Norfolk coast. He was a great walker and great outdoor man in so far as Norfolk was concerned. He went to Lebanon to stay with an old king's man who was a diplomat out there, one of the Redaway family, who was in the Foreign Office. But he had to come home. He got so homesick, he couldn't stand it. He became ill, away from his East Anglia. Though he did have relations in South Staffordshire, because when he'd been ill, he went and stayed with them, and I, who lived in North Staffordshire, I remember taking a case of wine to these relatives when I drove home one weekend. My mother and I drove down to, it was near Wolverhampton, to these relatives and gave them a case of wine that their cousin, I think, had sent. He was, of course, very much an East Anglian farmer, from farming origin. I mean, he was extremely interested in the land. He was, I remember we had a fellow called Salt, you know, George Salt.
George Salt, yes.
Who was a bit of a martinet. I mean, I was became very friendly with George, but when I first became a member of the college, I had a bicycle. Of course, I used to ride. I was living in Grange Road, and I used to ride in to collect my mail from the Potter's Lodge. And so I could push my bike to the bridge and then cycle over the bridge back home. And I remember very shortly after I became a member, Salt stopping me and saying, you know, how can you be riding your bicycle here? I remember saying to him, because I had been, I was 37 years of age, and I'd been a staff officer in the Navy during the war and various things like that, and I said, well, do I look like the sort of person who'd ride a bicycle where I wasn't supposed to?
To which he retreated, did he?
He retreated, he in silence. And, but I wrote, I told John Saltmarsh, as the Vice Provost of the day, I said, Mr. Salt was upset. Yes, he said, he's written to me about it, but I've written back to say that I thought the college was for the use of its members and fellows, and that Mr. Avery was therefore perfectly entitled to come and collect his mail, and if he wanted to ride a bicycle, that was his entitlement too. So he'd been pretty forthright there. I remember his saying, you know, I have so much to do seating people for bank for feasts, college feasts, of which we seem to have more in those days than we have now. He said, I have to have sandwiches in my room for lunch. And but eventually he became very reclusive. I remember Mr. Goods, the butler, getting very worried and asking me whether I could go up and see Mr. Saltmarsh and find out if he was all right.
Was he in those rooms which are now known as the Saltmarsh rooms?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I know he's all right because I do see him from time to time. But he became very reclusive. And his voice used to rise. In those days we had wine served with dinner, free. Claret, of course. And I remember how I used to listen to his voice going up and up the more claret he drank with his dinner until you got to the stage when it's the Spencers, the only family I know of who rose from the rank of shepherds on the hillside to an earldom in three generations. And that was the kind of remark that typical John remark.
The other medievalist at that time.
I never hear the word Spencer without remembering it.
The other medievalist at that time was Arthur Hibbert. Did you know Arthur at all?
Well, Arthur, of course, got very unhappy. I mean, he and Marion, she was Canadian Pacific Railway, and they lived at Grantchester, and the marriage sort of came unstuck. And Arthur and I, well, he was a tremendous talker, and quite a brilliant talker. Didn't write anything, but he talked very well, and talked very well. But I remember I used to sit up with him. We'd drink a bottle of whiskey in a night. And he's living in Cambridge.
He's still here, yes.
I want to find out how he is, because I was fond of Arthur, but well, of course we never see him now.
Yes.
And well, I think he feels that the college is not the sort of college that he knew. I still love the college, of course, and I'm very fond of these rooms, and very lucky to have them. But no, Arthur rather sort of became aloof.
I heard he found, I think he became financial tutor or something like this, and found it all a terrible strain, and then resigned? Because I think he resigned his fellowship, did he? Or did he just withdraw?
No, I think he's still a fellow.
Is he?
Yes. Yes, I think he never resigned his fellowship.
And what about Christopher, if we're on historians? I shared a room with Christopher for some years. Yes, what was he?
He was a splendid man.
Christopher Morris.
He was a very close friend of mine. He used to come every Monday evening. He used to dine in on Monday evenings. And he'd ring me up and say, the rather characteristic way of speaking that he had, are you by any chance feeling a little thirsty? And I used to say, yes, Christopher, and it'll be sherry in my rooms because I'm expecting a telephone call, and I've got the sweet sherry that you like. So he'd come down and sit there and we'd have wonderful conversations.
He was in the room where I am now, I imagine, in G2.
He was on this staircase.
Then. Was he?
Mm. Yes. In a room which he shared with Braithwaite.
Oh.
And when Braithwaite insisted on my having a table, because he used to say he'd so enjoyed sitting in these rooms, he was a strange and exciting and tempestuous sort of character, Braithwaite was, with a very powerful wife, appropriately known
Margaret.
Margaret Masterman.
Mm.
That was sort of a very appropriate maiden name from Margaret. You knew them, did you?
I shared a room with Richard for 4 years.
Oh, you did, yes.
I was in H3.
That's right.
But I was wondering whether... Richard showed me the famous poker, you know, Popper's poker.
Yes, I don't know about that.
Well,
I
mean, it disappeared, didn't it?
Did it? I don't know.
Yeah, it has disappeared.
I see, I didn't know. Mm. It doesn't surprise me. Sorry, it's disappeared.
It's where the Cambridge Philosophical Society used to meet, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Yes, there was a row between Wittgenstein and...
Popper.
Popper, yes. Mm.
And the political society, which I think...
Oh, met there too, under Christopher's ages. Mm.
And then later in the outside room of where I am now, in G2,
yes.
It was started by Oscar Browning, I think.
Yes, it was, yes. Christopher knocking his pipe out on the fireplace. In charge... Yes, I used to go to that society.
I was wondering whether you did, yes. And they had that system of drawing lots for who was going to speak.
That's right, yes. I never spoke, actually.
Or rather, who would ask questions?
But I heard some interesting people speak, including Christopher.
Yes. Did you know Morgan Foster at all?
Oh, very well, yes.
Hmm.
Latterly, to save the college nurse coming in at 10 o'clock at night, I used to give him his pill and put him to bed. One of my stories about Morgan Foster I tell apologetically because it shows a certain rather feline side to his character. But the ladies, the wives of the fellows, Sheila Lumby and Cicely Leach and Helen Morris and his others, made special dishes and gave him a little dinner in his rooms one night. And each of them had contributed one of their little masterpieces. And, of course, I was told about this. I went up at my usual 10 o'clock, and he was sitting, as usual, looking at the fire. And the fireplace was his mother's, you know, and he had brought it to the college. Noel said to me once, he said, remember, it made him an honorary fellow. We didn't, in fact, expect him to live in the college, but he not only lived here, he brought his mother's fireplace. It's still there, of course.
Is this in A staircase?
Yes, it's now the senior middle...
Common room.
Common room bar. But the fireplace is still there. And of course I knew that this had occurred. It had all been cleared away, the table and everything. And we sat and he said there's I had a very nice dinner brought by some ladies. I said, oh really? Did you enjoy it? He said, yes, it was very nice. Very nice, these ladies. Kind. Who were they? Well, somebody I told the story to said, oh, it was just an old man. Forgetful, I said, no, no. I knew my Morgan Foster perfectly well. Who were they? And I remember when the news of the News Chronicle folded up, and we were in the combination room, and I said to him how sorry I was that it folded up. It was the one newspaper that had a sensible horoscope in it. And it's the only time he and I ever had a row, or something like a row. He said, sensible horoscope? There's no such thing as a sensible horoscope. It's all rubbish. I said, well, the news of the News Chronicles was better than most. Natural nonsense. It's a lot of rubbish, that was. I said, well, okay, yes. He was very angry.
Mm.
But I also remember Crick, who could be an extremely objectionable man.
Francis?
Yeah.
Mm. He wasn't ever made a fellow, though, was he?
No, he wasn't, but he was given the hospitality of the college. And I remember his saying, he was talking to Morgan in the combination room and said, well, of course, it was something to do with marriage and the biology of having children, something you would know nothing about, of course. Which, of course, was, well, a sort of reference to Morgan's homosexuality.
Mm.
And
How did Morgan reply, or did he just...
Yes.
Did you know James Watson as well, or just Francis?
No, I never met James Watson. I think he was a much nicer man.
Francis Crick apparently was offered a fellowship, but he said he would never come to a college which had a chapel.
That's right. He went to Churchill before it had a chapel. Yes.
Hmm.
I'm glad in a way he didn't become a fellow. I think it would have been not a very pleasant colleague.
Hmm.
But of course I don't know half the fellowship now. Then we all knew each other. You know.
Hmm. The ones who are still... I mean, you mentioned Dan Brown.
Yes, Dan.
Dan and Margaret. And Margaret. I mean, Dan was vice provost, of course, at one point. How do you get on with Dan?
Very well.
Well, everyone gets on well with Dan,
yes,
I imagine.
Yes, a very good friend of mine.
Mm. And Hal Dixon?
And Hal is a very good friend of mine.
Another vice provost?
Yes, he's very worried. Of course, he's very ill.
Yes.
I was very fond of Hal. And of course, I was very fond of his elder brother, Kendall.
Mm.
Who used to say that I was the only person he could hear properly.
He was very deaf, wasn't he, at the end? Mm. He had hearing aids.
I wrote to Adrian when Adrian became Master of Peterhouse recently. Said that his father, Anne, told me that Kendall said that I was the only person he could hear easily, and I said to Adrian in my letter that in fact it was because I always arranged him to sit on the sofa with me in a certain position, so it was easy for me to throw my voice across to his infirm ear.
Mm.
And Adrian said, yes, he remembered his father saying, well, he liked talking to me because he could hear me easily.
Mm.
And
I
was on the wine committee, and of course he was secretary of it. He'd say, talking of being thirsty, he'd ring me at six and say, would you like to try some of that? I think, Peter, that we ought to try some of the claret. It's a question of temperature, you see. I think we ought to... Would you come round at about 6:30 and we'll taste some of them and see how it's going? And I'd go up to his room and Mr. Goods would have covered a whole table with bottles and we'd sit there and sip clarets until about 10 o'clock when we'd have to help each other down the steps.
Where was his room? Which room?
It was on that corridor, the librarian.
Oh, yes, I know.
The corridor that leads to a side door, as it were, to the salt marsh.
Yeah.
In fact, the entrance to the salt marsh, as it was.
Mm. Yes.
Yes.
I remember him.
And an Irish hunting table there, very beautiful. Gate-leg table.
Mm.
They had some nice furniture in their house too.
When you were talking about religion and being too ecumenical for some of the Catholics here,
yes,
do you think your time working on Persian poetry and culture and religion had any effect in making you...
It's very important. Sufism has a very great influence in my life and becoming increasingly so.
Mm.
And of course the poetry is mostly the medieval Persian poetry that I sort of rather specialise in is of course Sufi written.
Mm.
Sufism, I feel, with its tolerance and its ascent above the material, is really, I've come to the conclusion in the world as it is today that Sufism could be one of the last hopes of a religious synthesis that would help us to a better life. Because, of course, its essence is love.
Mm.
Of which there seems to be very little nowadays.
Hmm.
And chief concern nowadays is with materialism and unleavened sex without sex not leavened by love and lust and so on. And Sufism rises above this and the Sufi endeavours to get himself above this type of mundane condition. He accepts the world, however easy he comes back to influence it if he can. He has to be a teacher. But Sufism, I think, is a very important repository of what you might call religious aspiration and hope.
You've never... been tempted to convert to?
No, never.
Hmm.
No, because a formal Islam is a Semitic religion. One of the things, of course, that Sufism does, while it's essentially part of Islam and makes it clear that it is, but of course what it does is to try and introduce an element into a Semitic religion which is lacking in that religion. That religion being arid, legalistic. Theology in Islam doesn't really exist, it's law.
Mm.
And Sufism is the ameliorative factor there. And the ascent of Islam to a religious and spiritual position which can satisfy the heirs to ancient spiritual religions like Manichaeanism and so on, and Zoroastrianism, characteristic of the Middle East before the Islamic conquest.
Hmm.
But they respect Islam as a great religious force, of which they regard themselves as exponents. But of course they add to it a very great and important element. The reactionary Muslims, of course, Muslim regimes like the one that's at present operative in Iran, and like our friends the Taliban of Afghanistan, of course, they're against Sufism. The present regime in Iran has arrested several Sufi leaders and broken up Sufi gatherings, which of course is, well, very much, I suppose, a pattern with any kind of totalitarian type regime. Fide Hitler and the Masons.
Mm. Does the mysticism of Sufism...
It is mystical. It is about mysticism. Mm.
Does that attract you?
Yes, very much.
Mm.
Well, I mean, it's a rather loose word, mysticism, really. But of course it is a mystical religion. It's about origins and causes beyond the immediate comprehension of the rational world. It's beyond reason.
Mm.
It deals in metaphors.
Mm.
The world is a metaphor for the world of reality. And therefore it has affiliations with Gnosticism and Platonism. and Neoplatonism and certain Indian cults. And it's influenced by both, from the West, Egypt, and the Gnostics, and from the East, India. And of course it is an example of a religious reaction to an extremely disturbed and cruel world. Therefore it's very appropriate that people nowadays should be turning to it as they are. But of course it flourished after the Mongol invasion of northeastern Iran. An appalling, something almost comparable with the devastation caused by an atom bomb. An appalling destruction. And Sufism, it was the Sufis who started to revive life, who taught people how to make candles and how to tailor clothes and how to make bread. People who completely, the few survivors who didn't know these things, the necessary adjuncts of living. In cities which Genghis Khan had ordered the total destruction of, even to the extent of going back a few days later to catch those who'd hidden in underground water channels and cellars and so on, and then plough the area up. It's very grim. But we live in times when these horrible events can be understood in terms of what's happening today.